You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. It's Tobin Arthur with the Innovation for Alpha podcast, and I am joined today by Dr. Viraj Mane, who has got a very interesting story, very interesting company, and I'm very excited to kind of dig into it. Viraj, thanks for spending some time on a Friday afternoon with me.
Great to be with you, Tobin.
Let's go back just a little bit. Why don't you give everybody a sense of your background? How did you get, you know, your PhD work and how you got into the company?
Yeah, I was one of those classic nerds that assumed I'd be in the ivory tower for life. Did my PhD at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Wonderful program, made many of my best friends there. And I was in a molecular and human genetics program. So definitely a good introduction into really severe congenital diseases, especially the rare ones that, you know, almost none of us have ever met someone with these. But if you have it, you and your family are very defined by the realities of that condition. So that's kind of backstory. But then fast forwarding to about 9 years ago, I became a dad. So I've got a very active daughter. And rolling in some of my experiences in the sciences, immunology, virology, genetics, of course, and seeing these stacks of milk pouches that were beginning to accumulate in the freezer, which is common for mothers that are pumping late at night or pumping at work, and you know, might not use every drop, so you just save it for later. But ultimately, you don't use all of it, and so what do you do with that? And so that got me thinking as a new dad and a scientist, like, well, these things are packed with all kinds of nutrients, in particular antibodies or immunoglobulins. Is there a play to make that available somehow for a clinical purpose? And then again, with that genetics background, I said, okay, well, I know there's so many hundreds of immunodeficiencies, which patients might be missing the specific antibodies that are in milk? And the answer is there are a couple of rare diseases out there where the IgA antibodies that they don't produce, which happen to be the most predominant form in human milk or breast milk, you know, not having those leaves them highly susceptible to a whole range of infections, especially mucosal infections in the respiratory and the GI tract. And, you know, just to make it more real what that actually means, we're not talking about a few more sniffles and colds per year. I mean, that wouldn't be that bad. This is like severe infections, hospitalizations, strong antibiotics, much stronger than what you or I probably take, the need to have those infused. So that's happening in an infusion clinic or a hospital, not from the convenience of home. And expensive blood products that are infused into the arm, that's taking 6 to 8 hours per infusion. That happens once a month for the rest of their life. You really can't ever wean yourself off the treatment. So, you know, if you just start thinking about what does that mean to your ability to finish school, hold a job, have a family, these are very transformative conditions. And the existing treatments out there, they can't fully protect you from infections, you know, not even close, and they're expensive and they're invasive. And so there's just this huge gap where, you know, where these patients are versus where a normal patient is, there's a massive gap in the middle. And so really trying to create clinical value out of these milk antibodies targeted for those patients, but having an eye towards expanding to additional indications, that's when I began to realize, like, you know, as a geneticist, like this could be a solution to a very intractable problem scientifically, medically. But then, of course, if you don't have a business case behind that, you know, where are you? You're just kind of at the project stage. So it's been about 4 years of really building out, like, this is a business case. We're not just trying to, you know, be do-gooders in a lab. This is a functioning business. So I'm really proud of where we've gotten so far.
Friends of mine who've been in the general space, particularly back in the Boston area, I remember one discussion we had several years back. We were talking about the rise of children with, you know, lack of ability to protect themselves against disease, even issues like peanut allergies. And we were talking kind of about all these related things. And one of the comments from one of the scientists was that they believe strongly that it's a couple of things. Number one, kids not being exposed to, you know, things earlier in life that historically they have been to build up their immune systems, not playing in the dirt, for example.
Yeah, constant use of.
And then the other was, you know, breast milk was, you know, more and more mothers not breastfeeding kids. And so all of those, some of the natural antibodies not necessarily getting built. So we'll get back to the company in a second, but I just want to get your experience in this space. Are the, do those things ring true, or is there any sort of, you know, societal trends that are leading to these immunodeficiencies?
Yeah, I think a lot of that makes sense to me. You know, I know enough about immunology to know that it is a gigantic field that no one person could ever understand in its totality. So, you know, the interesting points you've raised are more like neonatal immunology and the environmental triggers that are or are not present during their upbringing. And so very interesting stuff. You know, the role of breastfeeding, we've taken a really deep look at that. And there's almost a universal consensus among public health organizations like World Health Organization, United Nations, even the Gates Foundation, really unanimous support for breastfeeding as long as a mother is able to. Mm-hmm. And you're right. So then if you dig into the pediatric immunology cohort of physicians, you know, they would certainly be in the position to say that, you know, whether anecdotally or based on studies that have come out, breastfed infants have these outcomes and those are different from formula-fed infants. Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense. The milk banks, which we engage with, and I'm sure we'll circle back to that as well, you know, they understand this. They're living that experience with the mothers they engage with at all times. And so their mandate is also to support mothers that wish to breastfeed and some cannot. And there's biological reasons, there's economic reasons. We can get into those too, if you like, because I mean, that it's been a really educational experience to know what is the milk bank community? Why are they out there? Who are they serving? Why do certain babies and, you know, mothers need this support? And understanding that process helped us really tailor the message that we're coming to you, the milk bank director, because if we could work with you in this way that's never been done before, we could create this value that doesn't currently exist for this very vulnerable patient population. And it rolls in principles of diseases, infections, immunology that they understand really well because of their knowledge in the field. I mean, these are folks, when we start getting into the science, they already know it. And that's a very cool discussion to have.
That is cool. Let me go back a little bit to the founding of the company. Then you kind of connected some dots. You're based in New Jersey. Walk us through, just give people a sense of, so what was the, you had this epiphany, what were the steps that you took to get this, you know, off the ground?
Yeah, I love sharing this part because I think for founders, like, we recognize you do the things that don't scale just because you just need to get it done. And then eventually you can scale that up. So I'm going to tell you something that's very not scalable, which is, you know, as I said, I became a parent, had some milk samples, but then years later I said, you know, let me do some literature searching. I don't think this has been done. And I have some issued patents. So I have some sense of like the filter you should apply, the rigors you should apply to determine if the prior art is out there or not. Start with that because that's free. I'll say, okay, so at this point I'm satisfied. I don't think anyone's done this. I mean, the immunologists know it should work for adults, for, you know, people beyond pediatric settings, but it's never been done by a company. So this could make sense. So my next thought to myself is, well, what's the minimum proof of concept that I could do to show people that this project is worth expanding into something more? And so I just put the call to friends of mine, and I was in Toronto at the time, who happened to be like immunology PhDs, and they got the concept perfectly. And I had randomly stumbled across a conference of midwives. So it was a midwifery conference. Okay. And I said to those people too, like, this is just an idea, but you guys literally, your job is to work with lactating moms, new moms. What if this was a thing? What if this was a product? And within 2 minutes of each midwife conversation, they said, yes, that makes sense. The moms I work with would love that. Like, that should be a thing in the world.
Interesting.
So at this point, okay, there's some goodwill. There's some people other than me telling me I'm probably not crazy at this point. I said, okay, but the next thing is you got to get some milk and you got to do some testing. Yep. Now, I didn't have any from my child's birth. That was years prior. I asked these immunologists, you know, if there was a way to get some, maybe I could do some tests with local labs. Like, I knew enough scientists in the Toronto area that I thought we could just do some purifications, do some testing. So because they were friends of these immunologists, I wound up driving a rental car because I didn't have a car at the time to pick up milk samples from these new moms I'd never met. And so that was me in a rented car knocking on the door saying, hi, you know, we spoke about your milk. May I have that? Is that okay? And, you know, hoping they weren't going to call the cops on me.
Right, exactly. How does this get delivered, by the way? Is this coming in a bottle that's refrigerated? Or, I mean, how are you trekking this around?
Yeah, so it's very common for moms to have either like flexible pouches or even plastic bottles. Okay. And then those are sized so that a typical sort of session of expressing milk It can be up to like in the ballpark of 6 ounces. And so that fits nicely in one of these pouches. And then they usually stick it in a cooler or a freezer. And then when they get home, they'll put that in a freezer for longer term storage.
Okay.
So getting it's actually easy. It's just small containers, stick it in a cooler and then take it home.
Okay. So you're trekking around Toronto, picking up milk.
Samples. The milkman. In one of the cases, the husband answered the door, not the mom. So I was like, let him please know why I'm here. Because it's like, I am here for your wife's breast milk.
I'm really sorry. I swear.
Exactly. I promise this is for research purposes. I just had a laugh. I mean, they were totally fine with it.
Yeah.
But if I ever wanted to write a stand-up set, I would talk about the awkwardness of driving around milk.
I'm sure that could take a left turn pretty quick.
Exactly. Like, let me please not get pulled over right now.
So what'd you find? You get this to, you know, the labs and what was your initial investigatory work?
Yeah. So then we said, what are some really focused questions we can ask? I mean, there's no company. It was just the minimum to maybe prove the concept. So we just did some extraction work with a protein purification lab that was actually at Sunnybrook Research Institute, one of Canada's major research institutions. Mm. And it worked. You know, it didn't work the first time. And that's every founder knows that's typically the case. But we tweaked. We said, okay, I think I understand why, but let's try it this way. And actually came upon conditions that worked really well for what we were trying to do.
And what were you trying to do? So when you say it worked, what was it that you know, what was the goal?
Yeah. And so the goal was to extract all of the antibodies from a milk sample.
Okay.
So it naturally has an abundance of antibodies, extremely polyclonal, meaning they're raised against all types of different pathogens. It's the opposite of monoclonal antibody recombinant programs that pharma companies typically develop, which bind to one thing really well. This is almost the opposite. Okay. So you have truly broad spectrum protection against all the pathogens that these breastfeeding moms have encountered in their lives.
Interesting.
So the goal was, how do you get all of it? We don't want some. I mean, there's no reason to leave any behind. So how do you maximize the capture? Yep. So that's what these methods were based on, to have just the antibody fraction. And then getting it is one thing, but showing that it has some activity is the obvious next step. So then we, again, leveraged some R&D connections we had actually at SickKids Hospital, which is Canada's largest pediatric research center. And we said, let's test this against a really common respiratory virus. And the thinking was, if it's common enough, any milk sample you have is almost by definition going to have antibodies against that. And because if it's a common virus, it afflicts so many people that it also makes sense as kind of a proof of principle pathogen. And so we looked at RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, which is one of the most frequent causes of the common cold. So basically, all humans have had it by the time they've hit age 2. And then they probably had it a couple of times per winter, but you don't necessarily know because there's so many other viruses that cause the cold.
Right.
And so we did that testing in vitro, and we showed really compelling results. These milk antibodies could neutralize that virus by 85%.
Wow.
So off to a really good start. And that was a couple of years ago. We tested the same early prototype more recently, because again, it had been in a freezer for 3 years at that point. Okay. Tested it again to see if it had retained its activity, and it did.
Really?
So, you know, it's a pretty crude early set of experiments, but it was really, it showed the durability of the antibodies and the logic of the approach itself. So that's kind of what we have done. And I'm sure we'll talk in a bit about some of the next steps we have now towards actual commercial strategy.
Yeah, I want to get there. But you mentioned RSV and our kids, we have 3 kids. Two of them, but really one of them in particular, struggled with RSV when they were younger. And as you mentioned, particularly during the winter. We lived in Seattle at the time, so you had wet winters and so forth. And it was, there were some challenging moments where it was in the hospital and having to get pumped out and, to get all that mucus out. And really, there was not a lot that could be done, right? It was sort of like, well, it's got to run its course. We got to keep the air moving. But when you mentioned that it's got effectiveness against RSV, were you thinking that also could be a market in and of itself, given the fact that RSV is such a big deal amongst kids?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm glad you point out that there's not much that's done for RSV, even though it's very prevalent. And so there is one approved monoclonal antibody. It's quite expensive. Mm-hmm. And as is the case for quite a bit of the antivirals, unless you give it early enough in that course of infection, there's not much point, right? Okay. If it's an established severe infection and you try to mitigate, even if you're chopping off 20% of the viral load, qualitatively that doesn't do much of anything.
Yeah.
And so, there are limitations, as you noticed with your children.
Yep.
And so what we're proposing, and we haven't talked much about the immunodeficient patients, but we will, is that they're vulnerable at all times. It's not just the height of cold and flu season. It can be middle of the summer. And so the only way to provide meaningful protection to patients with that kind of susceptibility is to give it as a prophylactic, like a preventive treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the way that one of their key existing products, which is a blood-derived antibody product, is also delivered. I think I mentioned these infusions, which are very invasive.
Yep.
And you literally have to do it every month, because if you just allow the levels of those serum antibodies to deplete, you're back to being fully vulnerable, which you don't want to do.
Yep.
Now, the big difference with our approach, really the core differentiator with what we're doing versus those blood products that have to be infused or injected, you know, at a very frequent level, mm-hmm. is that the antibodies from milk are already known to be durable and stable in the mucosal environments. In fact, if you don't have an antibody deficiency, you're making a ton of IgA antibodies in your respiratory and gastrointestinal tract anyway. Because they're durable and they're unique in doing that, our differentiator as a delivery modality is to actually deliver them not by needles, no infusions, no needles, but to have oral products for gastrointestinal infection prevention, mm-hmm. and then inhaled products for respiratory infection prevention.
Okay.
Now you could think of nebulizers, which, you know, have the little chamber above your nose and mouth. Sure. And so you can gently inhale it in a way that coats all the respiratory tract. And then the oral products portfolio, that's even more obvious. You take pills or capsules or tablets, and then it coats the GI tract.
Yep.
Now, in both of these cases, almost anyone can do that. There's no specialized training. There's no phlebotomists and infusion clinics. So if we just think about the patient experience and then the expenditures associated purely with the administration of a therapeutic, you delete all of that out.
Interesting.
And that, I think, purely from a patient experience and patient compliance point of view, there's already significant savings. You know, you can roll it into a health economics calculation, which we're not smart enough to do yet, but we'll get the kind of support that can help us put some numbers on that. You know, we've done some white paper modeling, but it's not as sophisticated as it could be. But we can already speak to, if you just delete out infusion costs, you're already talking about $1 billion savings just in the US.
So make that jump. So you're finding effectiveness. How did you start zeroing in on PID and, you know, in the direction you were going to go?
Yeah, this came back to the earlier discovery. Okay, you know, there's not much prior art, so we think we could have patents. And we now have 3 issued patents, by the way, the US, Japan, and Canada.
Nice.
And we're working on European Union. So, you know, really, so far, batting 1,000 on patents, and I'm really proud of that.
That's cool.
But in terms of the disease state, again, being a genetics nerd in my past life, I said, what are the immunodeficiencies that probably make sense? And it turns out there's hundreds. There's over 400 diseases, many of them quite rare, that fall into a category called primary immunodeficiency, or PID, as you just said.
Yep.
Now, within that, there's antibody deficiencies. And then within that category, there's specific IgA antibody deficiencies. Yeah. And one of them is called common variable immune deficiency, or CVID. And the other is selective IgA deficiency, or SIGAD. Okay. In both of those situations, because the deficit is primarily in IgA, most of their body is pretty normal, except for the mucosal compartments. They keep getting respiratory infections. They keep getting GI infections.
Okay.
So if you look at the, you know, typical outcomes, it's just infection after infection. And the, you know, it's not exactly 50-50, but between respiratory and GI, like, those are the predominant infections in these folks. And it's the driver of hospitalizations. So at that point, it felt like a pretty clear lock and key fit that they're missing one thing. We're extracting primarily IgA antibodies. That's the one thing they're missing. So that's where it makes sense to propose it for those indications, because as your audience can appreciate, you can claim that 50 diseases could benefit, but you need to prove that you have a plan to put that in front of the FDA. So what one indication are you planning to make that case on?
Mm-hmm.
And these indications, given the close fit, are the ones that make sense. Now, what we also did, which I'm also excited about, just to really understand the pain point and the patient perspective, in addition to our own technical research, was to reach out, really just cold outreach to patient foundations that actually focus on primary immunodeficiency. Yep. And in the US, there's the Immune Deficiency Foundation. In Canada, there's the Canadian Immunodeficiencies Patient Organization. Yep. And their chief executives are, you know, they're close friends. They're like sister organizations. And so we actually formed relationships with the chief executives of both those organizations, I think back in 2017, which again, as I was driving around with milk in a rented car. So it was just concept stage stuff. But I said, you know, we're building this company because of the patients that you already advocate for. The more you'd like us to know about them and about your efforts, the better we can tailor some of our own efforts. And so those have been really fruitful discussions. And, you know, we just try to touch base a couple times a year. the last discussions have been more serious because they see all the traction we've made. And it's just nice to know that when we hit certain milestones, like clinical trial recruitment of these rare disease patients, that could be an interesting asset or value they can provide because they already engage with those patients. They know how to reach them. And you know, it's not that we expect them to endorse us in that way, but it's just about if we understand the pain points enough that we've satisfied some of their criteria, they can help raise awareness of what this could mean and help us get the kind of feedback that we continue to solicit.
Right. It's clearly a mutual benefit there.
Indeed.
So you started to touch on extraction and getting into a little bit of the business model. So let's jump to that a little bit. We'll move from the science for a minute and talk about, so now you're thinking, all right, if we could get enough of this and how does, you know, how are, if we're ultimately going to replace the fusions in certain select cases, because this is more efficient, et cetera, how did you think that through? And where are you today in all of that?
Yeah. So the current infusions, I think the right way to think about our intervention is more like an adjunct as opposed to a direct replacement. And that's because, you know, infused products, those are serum-derived antibodies that are destined for the serum of a patient or destined for the blood of a patient. And so they're quite good at controlling systemic infections, but not much of that is going to get into the lungs or into the GI tract. So they don't provide a lot of coverage for the mucosal compartments that we focus on. Mm. So you could think of us as kind of the mirror image of that. We can focus directly on the mucosal compartments, which are still an unmet medical need. And, you know, having learned a lot about the biology of these dimeric IgA molecules, they actually don't exit the mucosal compartments that much. They're primarily deposited and retained in that compartment. Okay. Now, for us, that's perfect. We want lower systemic absorption because that's the thing the other product already does well. Mm-hmm. And we can focus on retention in the compartments that are not well served. And really, my philosophy scientifically has been, let's leverage the natural attributes as best we can, because you could bioengineer an antibody to do something different, but you know, all the recombinant antibody programs out there, you hit a lot of hurdles because you're working past the biology instead of working with it.
Makes sense.
And that, you know, again, from a competitive differentiating point of view, we're doing the thing that existing antibody products don't do very well. So what we are hoping is that we can decrease the reliance that patients currently have on those infusions, because you're looking at 12 to 15 infusions per year, and that's non-negotiable. But that's, you know, around $10,000 per infusion. Wow. There's it could be up to 72 hours of lethargy, headache, fever, vomiting, nausea for each of those events. And again, if you have a job and you take it on a Friday, you know, maybe you're okay by Monday, but that was a miserable weekend. That's a compromise that has to be made by these patients. And so our thinking is, if we can decrease the reliance on the existing therapy, because this non-invasive and lower cost and easier intervention controls the frequency of infections in a given period of time, that's a trade-off they'd be happy to take. And again, that's trying to understand the feedback we've gotten from these patient foundations.
So are you thinking, for example, that instead of monthly, that it may be every other month, for example, if they're adding your product and in your process in, or how are you thinking about that, you know, addition?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, first we can, in terms of thinking of clinical trial design, there's our own intervention by itself. That has to be a tightly controlled set of clinical trials, of course. Yeah. But the follow-on could be something like what you proposed, which is now look at this, you know, the ability of introduction of a new product to decrease the requirement or the consumption of the existing product. Yeah. And you can, of course, model that in a different way, probably a different clinical trial. But point is, the health economics would support that pretty quickly. When you start decreasing the most expensive, I think the stat is that IVIG is in the top four in terms of expensive Medicare approved drugs, but it is accessed by something like less than 5% of the population, because again, some of these are rare conditions. Yep. So you have this massive health expenditure, which the benefit is required, but it accrues to this tiny population because of the low frequency of the diseases.
Yeah. Interesting.
So the math begins to work in our favor pretty quickly.
So speaking of the math, let's get to the kind of extraction, collection. You know, what do you anticipate there? And, you know, you've mentioned breast milk banks as a partner and a resource. Kind of walk us through that whole part of the operation.
Yeah, this was a great set of discussions. And Much of this started again with cold outreach to executive directors of a few milk banks. Now, very luckily for us, some of the first people we reached were milk bank directors who have an entrepreneurial slant and who see the value of diverting something that was not going to be used, and I'll tell you why, into a new pathway, a new biotechnology supply chain. So to give a little background on who they are and what they do, there's actually over 700 milk banks around the world, about 32 of them in North America. Now, we've all heard of blood banks. Not all of us have heard of milk banks, but they procure milk from mothers who have extra. And the preference is always for mothers to be able to exclusively breastfeed their own child. So that's sort of the top priority. If they have extra, they donate it to milk banks. The milk banks pasteurize and pool that to make it a genuine human milk product that is then available for medically fragile babies, preemie babies being the most visible example, because they're almost too small to suckle. So you just have this milk, you put it in a mini bottle, and then they're able to consume that nutrition.
Interesting.
That's not the only reason. You have babies that have other health conditions. Necrotizing enterocolitis is flagged as a pretty serious concern that is actually treated quite effectively by having access to human milk. So that's what milk banks do. And so they're collecting milk. They literally have freezers. They obviously do rigorous testing of the moms as donors, as well as the milk samples themselves, to determine eligibility. Now, as soon as you have eligibility criteria, some of the milk will fall outside of that criteria. So they're excluded. And there's a couple of different reasons. The samples can simply be too old, or their bioburden, meaning their bacterial count, is above a threshold, at which point they're not used. And the third reason, I think, is very interesting. It can be as simple as the donating mothers having prescription medications in their system. And that can be as simple, this is, you know, we're not talking hard drugs here. It could be as simple as blood pressure meds and antidepressants, which, you know, for better or for worse, are actually fairly common among new moms for postpartum depression and things like that. And so these are, again, moms that have samples they're interested in donating, but in these cases, they are told, no, unfortunately, we cannot use your sample. So there's a lot of reasons to exclude samples in today's workflow at milk banks. What we've approached them to say is that, of course, we have no interest in diverting or interfering with your core eligible supply for eligible recipients. I mean, that would be a non-starter if we even ask that question.
Sure.
Obviously. So the question became, of this unused supply, we can create clinical value. You have flagged that as trash, as refuse. It literally gets dumped down the drain, which no one feels good about, but they have no use for it. So what else would you do with it, right? They even mentioned, you know, you're thawing milk that could be spoiled. Like, the smell is actually quite bad. So no one's happy that it's being discarded. So our pitch was really, if we can access that supply and create a framework that feels ethically and financially fair to the milk banks, then we can now have a diversion of what was flagged as refuse into the manufacturing stream that we are defining.
So give us a sense. You mentioned 700 banks. Is excess something that most of them experience? Is it episodic, meaning sometimes they have excess, sometimes they have scarcity? I mean, what's the abundance or lack thereof, you know, for most of these?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a lot of assumptions that, like, why would anyone agree to give it away? And is it like you have peak sometimes and then the milk bank is empty? That's absolutely not the case. And so our first question to them was, is this scalable? Is your supply fairly consistent? And the answer is yes. Okay. The percentage that can be discarded can be up to 15% at every milk bank. Wow. And that, you know, so there's always going to be supply that can't be used for their core purposes that will be available for this purpose. And then, right, so we have signed commitments for supply from a handful of milk banks currently representing the US, Canada, and the UK. So we've been really aggressive in our early outreach just to find the types of champions that might make, you know, a non-binding but still, you know, a meaningful commitment to continuing to partner with us while we all work together to build out what does this look like as an actual contractual supply chain? Because now we're moving forward from intent into commercial supply chain.
Sure.
And that is actually the process that we're focused on currently with our legal counsel. So that really cross the T's, dot the I's. This has to be a functioning contract that represents our interests as well as the milk banks.
Okay. Let's talk just to, you know, maybe address for a second, well, a few things. Let's go to next steps. You mentioned you kind of got where we are at the moment, but what's coming up? What are you working on? What are you focused on? Then also would want to get a little bit deeper in terms of the business of the business. So capital raised to date, capital needs, some of those things. But let's kind of give a sense of where you're at today. What are your primary focuses for the next 6-12 months?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's an exciting time. So we've moved from some of those early lab grade engagements to show that, hey, this thing neutralizes a virus at the lab scale. And now we're focused on manufacturing. So we did very crude extractions. They were patent enabling. So they're very valuable from that perspective, but it's not the method we would use when we get to an industrial facility. Okay. So the current engagement is really about that. Like, what are the FDA's expectations for the rigors of documentation and processing of a product? How are you testing the purity at the beginning, the end, and all the intermediate stages? You want to minimize losses, of course, and, you know, maximize your yield of just the globulins and make sure you're getting rid of everything else that could be considered a contaminant. So this exercise, I knew it would be rigorous, but the level of granularity we're now getting into, it's a little mind-boggling. At the same time, it's straightforward stuff, which is nice. Like, you're implementing filters and procedures and dialysis for specific reasons. So it is very logical, and I appreciate that part of it. So the engagement we're ramping up now is really focused on that, on the manufacturing, to show that we can implement an industrially appropriate and medical grade set of processes that would satisfy the FDA. Okay. Right after the manufacturing, we can also do the next critical step is, okay, you've extracted it. It has the product characteristics you think are suitable for a company that will go in front of the FDA. But of course, you have to test that product as well. So there's a whole suite of activities, some in vitro, but primarily animal studies, because this is where you start really generating pivotal data. Yeah. So we have some mouse studies designed. We actually have a hamster study for our COVID-19 program, which we should also circle back to if we can. That's actually our most active program. Hamsters are designated and agreed to as kind of the gold standard for small animals for SARS-CoV-2 in terms of the respiratory biology and disease progression. So these are all situations where we have the vendors ready to execute key studies that we have designed. And so that's kind of a good segue into the capital raise part.
Well, before we go there, then let's just touch though on, you mentioned SARS-CoV-2, hamsters. Just walk us through that a little bit. How did that materialize?
Obviously, we all recognize all of us in the scientific community recognize the pandemic potential of what we were seeing fairly early in the year 2020. Around that time, we had come across a human milk immunologist named Dr. Rebecca Powell at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. She's really built a career on the role of milk immunoglobulins and milk immunity for HIV, influenza. And so she was pretty perfectly positioned to understand the role of milk immunity for SARS-CoV-2. And there's really only a handful of labs at that time that were asking questions anywhere related to breast milk antibodies as it relates to COVID. Now, we actually came across her not through the scientific literature, but because she had been interviewed by sources like Forbes and Business Insider for opening a viral campaign to request donations from mothers who had suspected COVID-19. Remember, at that time, there were no diagnostic tests, so you couldn't even confirm it. But if you had these symptoms and if you suspect you had it, if you can make a donation, that's what she was doing. Okay. And the recruitment campaign blew up, went viral. She continues to have like hundreds of inquiries like per day. So she has this repository of milk samples from moms early in the pandemic. Now, of course, it's more likely to have a post-vaccinated mother as opposed to a post-infected mother. Yep. And so there are differences. You may have seen recent headlines that vaccinations may induce higher protective antibody levels than an actual infection, which is great news for people getting vaccinated.
Sure.
But seeing all this, we reached out. We said, I'm a nerdy scientist, as I mentioned. So I said, I really appreciate this research. Some of the questions you're asking from a bench research perspective are the same things we're asking from a translational perspective. I see synergy. I think we could support each other. It wouldn't be a competitive thing. What are your interests? And very luckily, having some early discussions, we agreed that a collaboration could make sense. We began to engage with her institution to formalize that. We're successful with that as well. So really happy about that. Now, it's been a very fruitful collaboration. We co-applied for a NIH R01 emergency award of $2 million, which we did get.
Nice.
So that's great support for her benchtop efforts, as well as some, a small piece of our company operations. Obviously, we're devoting a lot of time to this collaboration.
Yep.
We won a Canada India Foundation Award also for this COVID-19 work. And most importantly, the data sets that are coming out of that collaboration from her lab have shown 100% neutralization of the spike protein of the novel coronavirus in the presence of these milk antibodies from moms who have recovered from a COVID infection. So at the conceptual level, exactly what we would have predicted is what it's showing, that those milk antibodies are specific enough not only to bind to the coronavirus spike, but to prevent it from cellular entry, which is exactly what a therapeutic would literally need to do. So we're in a really happy place in terms of the proof of concept being that compelling. Now we've really tried to push hard, and this also feeds back into the, you know, the capital side, is we understand the manufacturing for the drug substance. We just chatted about that a few minutes ago. But the second half of that question is, what is the product or the formulation strategy? Because if it's an airway targeted device, you have to get this into a nebulizer.
Right.
And airway therapeutics were on our company roadmap way before COVID. So to get back to why we wound up in this space in the first place, we said, well, the urgency and the humanitarian need is beyond obvious. Our technology lends itself to this kind of application. What would it take to really design the same technology, but for this particular application? And if we could modify it to just so that the milk sourcing was from confirmed infected mothers, but everything else was largely the same, that makes a lot of sense. And so that's how we tried to push forward that program.
So I want to get back to the capital, but one other just logistical question. So I'm thinking about, you know, excess milk at the bank. How does that relate? How does quantity relate? Because, you know, you mentioned, for example, 6 ounces might be a typical session. What are you seeing, or what is your hypothesis, depending on how much, in terms of what volume is going to be needed for a typical patient? So you can kind of correlate supply versus the demand need.
Yeah, good question. And obviously, we're not at dosing in large animals yet. So that's what will allow us to answer that definitively. What we have done in the meantime is to look at the literature for references of globulin delivery to the respiratory tract or globulin delivery to the GI tract. And that is out there. For the respiratory, there's not much, because this is pretty blue sky stuff, which is why we're the ones facing all the challenges, but we're also the ones with the competitive moat around this application.
Sure.
Now, what we do have available is some small animal studies, some primate studies for antibody delivery, typically monoclonals, sometimes Fab fragments, not even entire antibodies. So it's not an apples to apples fit for what we're proposing, of course, but you have to take what benchmark you think is available. So based on that, based on crude extractions of average human weight versus average animal weight, we think that a single dose could be in the order of 5 to 10 milligrams of milk antibodies, which is not a lot. The dosing regimen based on the half-life, remember, these are hardy and durable antibodies. They don't break down immediately, even in the harsh compartments, such as the GI tract. Based on that, we've seen that the half-life could be around 6-7 days, which means you would not need to give this thing daily. We don't think that will be a requirement, which again is great for patient compliance and convenience. And so if this thing is given weekly or even biweekly, it's very low effort. It's very easy, convenient, non-invasive. And then in terms of how that maps back to original supply, using the same math I told you about, if we take today's commitments, so just the letters of support, which outline the volume that's historically discarded by the milk banks that have provided these letters, and you convert that to the dosing I just mentioned, that already puts us in the ballpark of treating tens and tens of thousands of patients with these primary immunodeficiencies, just based on today's commitments.
Okay.
And again, there's 696 other milk banks in the world that we haven't engaged yet, but that we will, of course, look towards. So kind of the sky's the limit when it comes to accessing additional supply and scaling up the network over time.
Very cool. And so you've raised capital to date. Walk us through the history and then what's next on that.
Yeah, we've been, we've struggled as first-time founders in the biotech field. We've had some very hard-won successes on the funding side. We've raised over $500,000 total. At this point, the majority of that is investment. Some of it is non-dilutive sources like the NIH grant and a couple of demo day and other startup awards we've gotten. So grateful to have that mix. Now, we've been very lean with our dollars. I didn't mention before that we're primarily a virtual biotech. So I hold most of my meetings the same way we're speaking right now.
Sure. Not uncommon, by the way.
Exactly. And, you know, it's so unquestionably lean to do it this way, right? We have no scientists, no lab space, no, you know, equipment. And science equipment isn't like buying a laptop. It's like $20,000 for something as big as a shoebox. So it's not a practical way to spend money. So we've leveraged these research institutes, the CDMOs, the vendors we mentioned before. And so we've been lean. We've generated the 3 issued patents, several data sets, several legal activities and contracts. With the money that I mentioned, the $500,000. And some of that money is still cash on hand, which is lucky. And our current round and some of our engagements with AngelMD, which has been a great process. So thank you again for walking us into this community. You know, now it's the great thing is reaching people who already know the pharma world or the medical world and telling the story with all the de-risking we've already done, that puts us in a good position. And so I would say for maybe the first time throughout this process, we're actually seeing legitimate froth around the company, the valuation, the fundraising mechanics, and the story seems to resonate. So we've had inbounds from some people that are just friends and family that have watched the journey on LinkedIn for a couple of years, people that have heard about us through other investors saying, you know, we might be, you know, institutionals for this round or your next round. And so I think that's a great place to be in. So we're just keeping that momentum going. We originally had this story in terms of the last few months saying, okay, you know, a $250,000 top up lets us hit our seed stage milestones with enough cushion so we're not scrambling at the end. You know, as a minimal, you know, extra raise, that could do the trick. What we're hearing, and sometimes the big investors want you to think bigger, is like, well, if we raised, I don't know, 700K instead, we could actually push a lot harder, bring in a lot more resources, get ourselves to clinic that much faster because we're not pausing the fundraise once again. So, you know, they're both attractive for very different reasons. And I think we're just trying to be agnostic and practical, saying if the money suggests we can do the bigger raise, let's do that. And if that's going to be too much of a time distraction, let's just be satisfied with the smaller raise and execute on a smaller set of deliverables. We're trying to be agile and responsive. So like, if I could dictate the terms, I would have put fundraising behind us a year ago, but that's not the reality for early founders.
No, that's a good point. And I want to come back to that a little bit, maybe talk on the milestones. So as you hit this raise, what are the, you know, two or three key things over the next year that are going to get you to the next inflection point?
Yeah, I think we're really focused on just really hard hitting deliverables that show traction for a biotech company. I'll list three for now. So the first is completing the manufacturing we talked about. Like, you know, it's a first relatively small batch engagement, but you have to prove you can make a little bit before you spend 10 times the money to make a GMP batch. So that's one, small batch manufacturing. The second is testing the efficacy in a whole variety of viral and bacterial models, both in vitro and in mice. And again, for the primary immunodeficiencies, we need to demonstrate to those patients that this protects them against the broad range of infections they currently are vulnerable to. Okay. If it, you know, if it counteracts one or two, but none of the rest, that's very limited value. So we have to clarify that broad spectrum is the goal. The third one is to take those data sets as soon as they're ready, and then to actually start filing for orphan disease designations. And as your audience can appreciate, if a company is granted those certifications by the FDA, that's really a significant value driver, not only because, you know, it represents a certification, but also there are significant market incentives associated with that. Rare disease designations come with the 5-year market exclusivity. But even more impressive than that, having a registered novel biologic, which is the category our product would be regulated in, and we you know, engage the FDA to make that determination, a novel biologic actually comes with a 12-year market exclusivity, which is the most generous of the market, you know, items or market opportunities that the FDA sanctions in that way. And so that one makes sense, the orphan disease designation, because the orphan disease allows waivers of the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, which is about $2 million per drug application. So as we start doing these more regulatory and drafting exercises, they can create tremendous value. And again, with our success with some of our grants in the past, like, and our patents, you know, writing stuff down that brings ROI to the company, we're pretty darn good at that. So that's going to make a lot of sense as probably that third deliverable, because we don't need to bring in a lot of extra people. It's myself and my co-founder, Rick and Mehta, at our laptops sharing the document. I mean, that's a really good use of time is what we found, because it brings so much return back to the company.
That makes a lot of sense. Obviously, capital, people that have an interest in the space, is a, you know, a key objective right now. Are there any other things that you're looking for that, you know, help the company with any of these key milestones?
I think we have a good sense of what we're not good at. You know, I'm the R&D sort of nerd half of the company. My co-founder is actually ex-FDA, ex-Pfizer, ex-Aquestive, which is a generics firm. So when it comes to go-to-market strategy, deep regulatory knowledge, he's the perfect complement to my perspective on the company. there's still a lot of gaps. You know, there's the specific activities to get something in front of the FDA. There's the manufacturing, especially. You start bringing in process engineers who can talk about the specifications of a filter membrane. I mean, that's so far outside of both of our worlds. We're not going to pretend we could just figure that out on the fly. You start to realize you need the experts. So reason I bring that up to your question is anything from the process engineering to the regulatory strategy to the physician perspective. Mm-hmm. And we have a medical advisor, so she's great. She actually treats patients with primary immunodeficiency. So these are the type of external resources that we learn a lot from. They really improve our thinking. And I think that kind of network, it really makes sense to grow that. You know, there could be a GI, a gastroenterologist, who sees certain complications of these patients that we haven't learned a lot about. That kind of expertise is just going to make us so much stronger and credible. Like, to me, this is based on the science first, the medicine second, and that's it.
I love it. We have a great network of gastroenterologists. So I'm hoping they engage similarly for pulmonologists, although GI is a big, big part of our network. Let's maybe wind this up, and I'd love to keep tabs. So as you guys hit milestones, you know, I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about some of those. You've got a pretty good year ahead of you, a good clip. As you said, there's some frothiness starting to develop because of the seeds you've planted and all the hard work. Is there anything we haven't talked about that's sort of pressing and that you're excited about that you want to touch on?
One question that gets asked a lot, which didn't come up today, is if this thing makes sense, how come this random two guys at Lactiga thought this up and no one else realized that this is an obvious thing that should be out there? We get asked that a lot. Okay. And I'll tell you already off the bat, I don't know the answer, but I can at least speculate. Which is the discussions we've had with the milk bank directors. They've told us point blank, like, you guys are among the first to approach us for this clinical therapeutic application of this resource that sits in our freezers and has been for decades. We always knew that there was something to be done here. No one's ever approached us. Again, I don't know why that is. I can't speak on behalf of major pharmas, but you know, they have incentives to keep technology in-house, and a recombinant program allows you to do that. And resourcing of a natural asset that's out there, that's a very different mentality. And for us, it was, that could work if we really could convince the milk bank and maternal community that this was a valid enterprise and it could create new benefit. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually especially proud of the relationship aspect that allowed the company to grow, because if we couldn't get buy-in from them, like, why would it be worth doing the technology, right? Like, you'd never have guarantees of supply. Right. Whereas we were in a position, as I said, that just today's commitments could theoretically translate to tens of thousands of patients being dosed or being treated. So I think the relationship aspect is something I'm very proud of, and that there's no question without that, the company, it wouldn't be worth building it out. So that's just something I like to share, because cold emails, cold outreach, like thinking at a very high level, telling these milk bank directors, like, this is just brainstorming. I haven't done the work and I don't know if I can afford it, but if I could, what would you think about that? It was really just like, can we have a really open-ended discussion? And they met me in that place every time. That's something I'm so proud of.
That's very cool. Yeah, you should be proud of that. Well, Viraj, thanks for your time. This is a great story, and you're just the person to lead it. I love where you closed with that, which is, you know, the question of why you guys. And I find that typically for any of us entrepreneurs, the answer is, you know, because we were kind of naive enough and dumb enough to jump in. You know, you stick at it long enough and you start to figure it out. And then people are like, wow, crap, that actually worked. But congratulations to you. Great success so far. We're going to be eagerly watching and supporting what you're doing. So thanks again for spending some time today sharing the story.
Thank you, Tobin. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.